Okay, thank you all for joining us on this Thursday afternoon, and for us to explore Writing Beyond and its rolling out into the lives of women everywhere. And so Judy and Catherine are with us, and perhaps others will join us here shortly. So we have a couple of issues that people have emailed me about who were not able to join us, but first I'd like to see if you all, those of you who are on the call, have things that you would like us to attend to.
No, not necessarily.
Okay.
Just see what other people have in mind.
Okay, that's good. How about you, Catherine?
Trish, as you know, I have the manual, and a number of people have written to me and asked me to send it to them, which I have done. And then they try to start up their programs, and they write to me, and they say, well, everything is working great from the manual, but how do we get money? And I tell them to call you, Trish, because I have no idea how to get money. After 10 years I've been doing this, I still have not had donations, and I still support it myself, and so I can't tell them too much.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, you know, that's a topic that frequently comes up in these conversations, and I can share with you some of the pieces of that. I think the piece that really the webinar that I did, and it's a part of the Writing Beyond training that is the on. Let's see, it's how to kickstarting a good idea into a broad-based community-supported program, which is it's part of the online course, and it's also available through the what? Catherine, what is the name of that service in New Hampshire that has the webinars that you are on as well?
Windrush Farms.
Yeah, Windrush Farms has a webinar series which addresses that as well, because you know, money for a program is basically one form of community support, and you really have to look at it that way, that people need to be enlisted for all kinds of community support in terms of volunteers and you know, donating materials and just generally becoming informed about it so that they can help their friends or family members who may have breast cancer. That's just how a nonprofit works in general. And and so it seems to me that there are there's two phases or maybe three phases to that whole process of enlisting money in particular. We don't really have time to go into the principles of how you bring that community support in, but it is available there. But to me, you know, I find that, you know, when you're initiating something like this program, there's often people out there who like the idea of it and show up to help out. And for instance, when we were starting Writing Beyond, a number of people gave us personal donations. In fact, one of them was for $5,000. It was from a woman who was a breast cancer survivor, and she came to some of our initial meetings, and she was volunteering. And it turned out she had a family foundation, and she gave us a one-time gift to help us get started. And she was very clear that it would only be the one time. Another person read it in the newspaper. We had a front page article about it, and she sent us a check for $1,000. I had no idea who she was. When I a few weeks later, I contacted her and asked to have coffee with her because I just wanted to get acquainted with her. And, you know, it turned out that she said, she was I'd say in her 70s at least, and she said that she had a long time ago been advised that it was more beneficial to give a large amount to something starting up than to give small amounts to a whole bunch of different groups. And so that she had decided to do that, and we were the ones who caught her attention that year. And so I've got to say that, you know, I'm giving you two specifics recently, but in the time that I've started up other organizations, I found the same thing, that if you get the word out, in other words, if you're reaching out for broad-based community support, and you're making it clear how much money you need, and that people will give, especially at the beginning. They want to help get something going. They want to see that you've done your homework, that you've got a good base and qualifications for making it, successful. But there are people who sort of enjoy that, I guess is what I would say. Then the fact is that grants and other kinds of financial funding aren't going to be available until you've got a track record to show that you were able to keep it going and growing, and that you have a viable business model, I guess I'd say. And so you have those 2 or 3 years where you need to find ways to make a financial model that will basically keep you in business. And, you know, so you charge fees. You can charge for your sessions. I chose not to for the individual sessions because I wanted to honor the fact that Writing Beyond participants were generally financially strapped and didn't need another financial burden on their shoulders following all the medical expenses. However, our group sessions that we have on Saturdays, we do charge for that. And the way we do it here, which is, again, it's customary in this community, and it's important that you look at what your customs are in your community, that we do it on a requested donation basis. And we request $50 to $75 per person, but, you know, sometimes people don't give anything, or they'll just give $5 or $10. Sometimes people give the $50 and they'll come at the end. We've had a couple times, and they give us more because they felt like it was so worthwhile. And so now we're in the for the last year, actually, I've been actively trying to write some grants and to solicit students in the college here, university here, actually, who several people had recommended that might be a source. However, we haven't found those students able to really follow through in writing grants. And so I'm actually putting that on my agenda, my personal agenda for this winter to research and write those grants. Now, I have several on my list that I'm going to pursue, and I've had suggestions for them from other people. So I do know how to write grants, but I felt like that was one job that I could hand off to someone else. However, it hasn't worked out that way. So so I'm feeling that I'm going to go ahead and write a couple of grants this winter, maybe more. And then if those go well, I will have a base for perhaps somebody volunteering and taking it from there. Yesterday, for instance, got evidently an enthusiastic approval from the local Jackson County Horsemen's Association, who is having what they call the Tata Trot Schooling Horse Show. I noticed last year that they had this in support of breast cancer research. And so one of our volunteers is a high school senior, and she is making she's been actually helping us for right from the beginning, actually, several years ago. But as a senior, she's making Writing Beyond her senior project. And so she's helping teach a couple of three sessions this month, and she initiated, at my suggestion, she went to the horse, she called them a couple of months ago, and then she went to a meeting last night that they had, and they have offered to split the proceeds for the horse show with us, and then the other half will go to the research with the hospital corporation here. So that's a huge piece for us to have that kind of, first of all, just the, I guess, the support with from the horse show community, and it'll bring in some money. And, you know, we're also, you know, another project we're doing is right during this month in particular, during Breast Cancer Awareness Month, we have baskets for hair salons to raffle off in during this month. They have baskets that are have some of their own products in it from that salon, and then we have a water bottle and a little poster that has to do with Writing Beyond and some little little handout cards for information, and so we'll see how that goes. That was an idea of one of our volunteers. And it seemed like a natural, and the 10 salons that have that are participating are enthusiastic about it as one of their ways of helping out. And so, again, it's an organic process. It all has to do with understanding that this is not just about raising money, but it's about, we're looking to broaden the awareness of breast cancer issues. You know, so I'm, you know, in about 10 days, I'm doing a presentation at the Asante Hospital Corporation. They're sponsoring a breast cancer survivors day of education, and I'm the either the first or second speaker on that, and it's all about ways for them to be nourished and refreshed. And it's not a medical approach, which is what they had last spring, which is all about medical research and new drugs and things like that. It was actually it was interesting, I will say that, it really was, and valuable, but in the end, it wasn't that inspiring for them. So they're having this other conference. So I'm not seeing it as a fundraiser. I see it as an awareness raiser, but that's what leads to the money coming in. So it's looking at money as being a vital part of our promotion of the program in general. And so, for instance, last night, I was sending notes to Hannah and her mother. They both together went to make presentation to the Horse Show Club, and Hannah had said, "Okay, I know we want volunteers and we want participants, right? That's what we're mainly asking for, right?" And I said, "Well, yes, but we also need money, and you need to find a way to talk about that, because they're kind of uncomfortable about it." So I just laid out a little bit, some of the points for them to make, you know, that we have a $30,000 a year budget, and we rely on community support for that, and it would just be great if the club would help us with some kind of fundraising, and so they're really stepping up to the plate in a way I didn't expect them to be quite so generous this first year. But I'm just bringing that up because I think it's hard for people to ask for money, the volunteers, and so they need to learn how to do that. We all do. We're asking for support. It's one way of support. Volunteering is one way of support. And there are people out there who are willing to give money if they're asked. But they need to be asked. And so there are people out there who are willing to volunteer in a lot of different ways, and they just need to be asked as well. They need to be made educated about what we need. And you know, there's no there's no, like, you ought to do this. You ought to volunteer, or you ought to give money or anything. It's just like, come and join us with whatever your resources are, what you would like to contribute. Is it your time? Is it some of your other resources? Is it your money? And so that's kind of the way I come at it. I've had some experience over the years just getting educated about it, I guess, from people who are professional fundraisers with nonprofits. And they have essentially led me in that direction of that you're out there seeking community support in all kinds. And so you really have to be out there. And it's a full-time job. You know,
Trish?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is Judy. Do you find it difficult, or how do you explain so that people can understand what it is that you do or we hope to do, and to make that clear so that they have enough understanding about this work that they want to participate financially or through their time? Because that's kind of where I get stuck. It's once they experience it, then they get it, but trying to explain it is the hard part.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you how I go about it. I mean, in my mind, I figure that everybody knows somebody who's had breast cancer.
Yes.
It might not be on their minds. They may not. In fact, sometimes I've had people say, "Oh, I don't know anybody," and then they'll say, "Oh, yeah, there is that woman in my church."
Mm-hmm.
Oh, but I haven't seen her lately, you know. So when they think about it, I can't imagine you'd be an unusual person who doesn't know anybody who hasn't had breast cancer. So I start with that premise that it touched their lives somehow, okay? And for some people, it's closer than others. Either they've had breast cancer themselves or a loved one has. But in the case of a loved one, they often are clueless about what that loved one has gone through, you know. And so I go at it that way, like for making presentations at, like, Kiwanis and Rotary and so forth. I'll just give you this, how I go do the spiel here in just a minute. But first I want to mention that, like you said, Judy, once people experience it, they get it, okay? And so we have that's what these Saturday events are for. They're really for the general public. You know, we invite any cancer survivor, their friends and family, any kind of healthcare professional who wants to find out what this is all about to come to this Saturday event, okay? And it's really quite different in many ways to what we do with an individual session. For one thing, nobody gets on the horse. And it's a group process. But, you know, I talk about it as that we're offering the same experience with a horse in terms of what the horse can offer anybody who has challenges in their life. So I bring it down to we all have challenges in our lives, you know, whether it's breast cancer or some other cancer or something else. Everyone's got challenges in their lives, and here's what horses can do for it, and we're going to have a taste of that today. At the group event is kind of the way it comes down to it. And so we have three horses and usually in about 15 to 20 people. So that, but we don't take more than 15 participants. The other five people are volunteers who help make it happen. So, you know, I mean, I talk about what it's like to live in modern times, to live a fast-paced life. And that we all have stresses, and that we are facing unique challenges at this time in history with climate change, and that we're being called to, you know, to be greater stewards of the earth, and that can feel so overwhelming with so many of the issues that are before us. We don't know what to do with them, so we shut them out. Okay, and so. What we're and that can show up in other ways in someone's life that they're just overwhelmed with the challenges, whether it's a divorce or a health challenge or whatever it is, you know, we're needing to bring creative solutions to that. We're needing to use more of ourselves, engage more of ourselves, more of our brains, more of our bodies, that we need to tap into the body wisdom that's available to us. And horses can help us do that because they have this acute sensing of the world. They have much better senses than we do. And they have this big heart. They have this heart field with the coherent heart rhythm that allows people to entrain to their heart so that you can experience this peace and calm and joy. And there's so many things. I don't even need to go into that because you know what it is, that the horses offer so many things for us to come into relationship with them. And then, you know, there's the whole thing. I mean, anyway, I mean, that's how I essentially come at it, okay? And by telling stories of how this, you know, how this has unfolded for people, how it's changed their lives, how, you know, I don't give names, but I give little stories about so-and-so came with these issues and it changed their life this way, you know, and people get it. I mean, when we do a club presentation, there's always a few people with tears sitting there. And, you know, sometimes they say, you know, I had no idea that my, you know, my sister was going through something like this, you know, because I spell out some of the usual issues, or they hear them from that story, what they're going mm-hmm. through. And then it's, you know, I give the statistics. It's at epidemic proportions, and that these are the typical side effects that people, women have, like 80%, there's statistics now, 80% of women have PTSD immediately after treatment. And they have different ways of getting through that, of coping with it. And some of them are successful and some of them aren't. And
excuse me,
so that, yeah.
Where do you get that statistic, 80% have PTSD?
It was an internet report, and if you go to my website, it's on there.
Oh.
I have the report on there.
Oh, and who generated the report?
I don't remember offhand. It was maybe a year ago, but it's on there. You can find it.
The reason
I think
I
it's
asked
on the,
you the question
it's
is
on the,
because when I claimed that this was a side effect when I first started, I had total resistance from all quarters. This was not something that people were willing to use, that PTSD, which was supposedly for war heroes, could be applied to sick women. And so I had a long haul in order to make that case. And that's
well,
why
I could give you one source that has studied breast cancer and PTSD. And if you look up Dr. Susan Love, she's a breast cancer researcher, doctor, and she posts cutting edge information with breast cancer research through an organization, her own organization, Dr. Susan Love, and she also has another program called the Army of Women, and she has survivors and actually all women, whether you're a patient survivor or never have been touched by breast cancer. And that's how she does her research. And she just posted recently that post-traumatic stress disorder is something that occurs post-treatment. So she has it documented, if you look her up.
Yeah. And so, Catherine, this actually brings up the fact that, you know, a lot of people are skeptical, I mean, throughout many years, about what horses can offer, especially when you start quoting things like that. And so it's always really important to quote research to back it up somehow with research because, you know, they've got this left brain skeptical mind, and you just have to quiet that mind. You know, I start with the Institute of Heart Math and the research that they're doing. And then I quote this study, and I'm going to look up Susan Love. The more research that we can find and quote, it's going to quiet that left brain skeptic so that they can hear the deeper message of what's happening, of what we're offering here. And that's just the way our world is. We're very, we live in a culture that's very, you know, scientifically based. And, you know, you got to show people, but you got to get them there first. They're not even going to come if they say, oh, that's hogwash, that can't be true. And so, you know, obviously some people haven't come to my program for that, probably for that reason, but the people who have come are spreading the word, okay? And so it's one little piece at a time. And I just became aware recently of the whole issue of fear. I applied to present at conference, and it was proposal was turned down. So I was just asking about that, and she said, "Well, she thought it would help if I added something in about the fear that people have about attending to this." And I was like, "Wow, I hadn't even thought about that. Even just hearing that they didn't feel like people would want to hear the presentation about horses and breast cancer because it brings up all their fears about breast cancer." And,
exactly. That was what I was up against. You remember my original presentation. Yes.
Yeah, and so it's helpful to name that. You know, I'm going to start naming it. And that helps people to not allow the fear to, because it can just, you know, it kind of just helps you to ignore it is what it comes down to. And that's why a lot of people probably weren't aware of what was going on with their loved ones because they were afraid.
That's why women don't get mammograms.
Yes, because they're afraid.
They're afraid.
So fear is an issue that needs to be attended to. And that's what Breast Cancer Awareness Month is all about. I noticed that a lot of it is about, you know, go get your mammogram and here's what happened to me, but I made it through and it wasn't as bad as I thought, or it was worse than I thought that I had all these people helping me. That's what helps people overcome their fear. But I realized the last few weeks that I just need to be a little more conscious about that. Like this presentation I'm doing in about 10 days, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it, but I'm just going to mention that sometimes keeps people away from some of the resources that are really available to them. And,
can I make a suggestion to you?
Sure.
The term, as I said, is associated with military experience, PTSD. And as I told you, I had friends who were actually, you know, working in the Veterans Hospital as psychiatric counselors for veterans. And then when I tried to get them involved in what I was doing, as I told you, the answer was, no way, this is not the same thing. Can't be the same thing. And it wasn't until I contacted the doctor who worked for Windrush Farms, who was a neurological specialist, and asked him what he thought about using the title PTSD in terms of the side effects from this experience. And he said, absolutely, it's PTSD because PTSD is a reaction to any life-threatening experience.
Right.
And breast cancer is certainly that. Now, he knew because he was a paraplegic and he had also been involved in equine therapy for many years as a supporter of it. He died shortly after I gave that presentation. But that's not the point I wanted to make. The question of fear is what I wanted to talk about. And if you recall my presentation, I talked about it a lot. In that presentation, and I have also since, but the fear is not just on the part of women who don't want to get their mammograms or don't even want to face the issue of all of the terrible things that are going to happen to them if they get treated for breast cancer, but the fear is also in the minds of their men. It's in the minds of the entire population because it is an epidemic. And an epidemic is something that can cause panic.
Mm-hmm.
And the treatment is really draconian. The treatment is extremely harsh and debilitating, mentally and physically and psychologically, financially and sexually. All of that. And that's the reality of it. And people don't want to hear that because, as you say, it inspires terror. So the PTSD is a cultural malady, not just the problem of the person having the breast cancer.
I had personally heard about PTSD long before the veterans piece came up. But in the popular world, that is, I think, where everybody now knows what PTSD because of the veterans issue having become so widespread. And really, post-traumatic stress is natural for any traumatic event like this, but it becomes a disorder when they're not able to get over it. Okay.
Or admit it. And so that's the dilemma.
Well, and that's what, that keeps them from getting over it, right.
Yeah,
and both in the case of the
veterans who don't go for help and in the case of the women for whom this kind of help is not offered by the medical or psychiatric community. It's just not offered because that's the level of denial, that there's no help offered.
Well, I've got to say the medical community has been really supportive here. They for the last year, people say, oh, I saw it in the doctor's office or I saw it in some medical place. So my goal this year is another thing on my agenda for this winter is to handpick a few doctors. And I have two in mind already, but I'm going to go in and personally ask them to start referring people. And that's a whole different thing. And
I tried that also, but I was turned down flat. Absolutely. Because that was in 2010. That was early. We've now had 6 years to work on this.
Well, and so I'm not going. I'm going to doctors who I know will have already heard about because it's in their office or they've been on our mailing list. And so I'm expecting them not to turn me down flat. I'm expecting them to, say that they will refer certain kinds of patients, and we'll talk about who those might be. And, I'm sure some of them will be more interested than others, but it's got to be that personal approach that's been we've been cultivating it for the last several years.
Yeah, that's necessary.
I'm sure that if I had tried to go and talk to any doctor except one I knew personally, two or three years ago, I wouldn't have gotten anywhere. I mean, I just knew that. But Robin Miller that was one of the main reasons that she did that video for us.
Right.
Was to give some validity to what we're doing, to give us one more piece of groundwork. It's part of what we...
Well, let me tell you an experience I had. I did find a doctor. She was a naturopathic doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And she was all excited about it, and she understood. As a matter of fact, she was the one who explained to me the functioning of the vagus nerve and enabled me to pursue that avenue of research to understand why this really happens, why this changes the neurology of someone lying on a horse that way. But then she wanted to bring her patients to me, to my one horse, bring 10 women and have put them all on one after another on one horse. And I could not explain to her that would not be fair to the horse. It would not be safe without preparation. And that I could not provide her with that with my one horse. I said, you could bring the women. Now, you say you bring a group of 20 people, including your volunteers, and don't get on the horse. For how long do you have them there and what can you do with them? In terms of the biofeedback part, I know you have a very exceptional horse, a horse that, really does not mind making physical contact with, a lot of people. I have now therapeutic riding ponies for mentally challenged and physically challenged children. And these little horses have to be, they're trained for sidewalkers and leaders and obstacle course to be absolutely safe for impaired children. They are not that responsive to adults. I don't think I could use them for the kind of work that you do with Mystic.
Well,
you have, have an answer.
I mean, I am happy to respond to that. First of all, you're asking about the group events and how we do that. Well, first of all, let's talk about the horses. I'm looking for horses that are responsive, or if they're, I mean, it, like with my two horses, I've worked with them doing liberty work to refine that responsiveness so that they are eager, they're eager to interact with people in a safe way. But I have to constantly train my horse handlers to maintain that safety and that responsiveness, because most horse people are not used to and don't feel comfortable with horses doing that kind of interaction with people. They're just not used to it.
Exactly.
They're used to horses being obedient and for performance purposes. And certainly my horses need to be obedient, but when they're asked to be, to do something, but the emphasis is on the relationship with the horse. And so that just takes training. I mean, they love the results, and so they're willing, but it's, they easily slip back into their old ways of being with a horse. And so that's one piece right there. And then I bring in, you know, one or two other horses at times that are not my own horses. And so, you know, I'm working with people where they understand what we're doing, and we keep the horses on a halter. The main physical interaction they have with the horse is greeting the horse and touching the horse and interacting with the horse. And the lead, whoever's leading the horses, has a lead rope, has to help direct that. You know, so that, because the person isn't necessarily going to understand the horse's body language and responses. And so they touch the horse, and they might do this kind of rocking that we have them do, rocking side to side. But, you know, it's preceded by my doing a demonstration of liberty work where I'm talking about, notice what the horse is saying. And my volunteers are stepping in there too, one in particular. But they say, now notice this. Notice what Trish is doing. And notice how the horse is responding. So that we're educating people about the energetics of what goes on between horses and humans in that little scenario.
So for your 10 people, let's say, you would get in with Mystic or your other horse and do a round pen demonstration of body
language. It's not in a round pen. I don't work in a round pen with that many people. That's way too restrictive. I would go in a group. I have them, they're cordoned off at one corner of the arena, and it's a medium sized arena. It's about the size of three round pens overall, and so I would go in there, because the thing is, you want the horse to have choice, so that they can see that if, for instance, I'm a companion walking with Mystic, and I start talking to the crowd, Mystic will walk away from me.
Yes.
You know, because I lose the connection with her. So, you know, so I bring the connection back. And so they see that. They see how her body language changes when I lose my focus. So then I say, okay, I'm not going to talk now. I'm just going to work with her. I'm going to focus on her. And then that's when my volunteers step in and start narrating what's going on. Okay, and so I can do it with my other horse too. I don't necessarily just do it with her, and sometimes I turn them both loose, and so that's a whole different dynamic of them interacting together and with me. You know,
how do these visitors on the Saturday have the experience of the contact with the horse after you've demonstrated?
So the three horses are on a lead rope, and we explain how to greet the horse, and no more than five people but they can't be close to the horse. They have to be back at least 10 or 12 feet. And they, one at a time, they go and greet the horse, and the horse will reach out and touch their hand. If the horse doesn't reach out, I mean, if the horse is not welcoming them, then they stop. And so then they learn how to be more attractive and you know, how to, using the body language, to ask for the horse's attention and the permission to come up and greet them. So
do you have trained volunteers with that many people coaching the participants once you start having interaction?
So we have
three horses.
We have a horse handler, and then there's other volunteers. And one of the most important volunteers is the person who is holding the field, holding the energy. So, this is something that takes a lot more time than a few minutes conversation.
I imagine it would take a lot of time to do it. That's what I was, my question is actually.
That's the first, we do all this in the first couple of hours. And then, there's a number of things that we do that you should just come up sometime, Catherine.
I wish I could, but I'm running a program here single-handedly with without this crew that you have and these little ponies. But,
that's kind of how I go at it. Now, I feel like I've just given you a brushstroke, but it's a lot more complex than that. But I do want to go into, there were two people who sent in questions. And one we've actually already handled, and that had to do with how I, she was asking if I charge for the four sessions, the individual sessions, and if so, how much, and I actually don't charge, but if I did, I would do a lot of community analysis about what would be appropriate. I don't think there's any hard and fast answer about that, in terms of my philosophy, I don't want to charge for those sessions, given their issues. The other person wrote in asking about the barrel, the details of how the barrel is constructed, and I'm going to send her some pictures. But the basics about the barrel is that you can go to the actually Google vaulting barrels, and you can find plans for constructing vaulting barrels online, the dimensions and the materials and so forth. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it takes someone who is skilled with metalwork, because they have to cut one barrel in half and weld it to a full-size barrel, and then you attach wheels to it, which a vaulting barrel does not have, in order to make it portable. And so there's actually, a discussion of this, the materials and so forth, about the barrel in the manual that I created. I think it would be helpful to have some close-up pictures of the barrel. We're not in session right now for the next few months, and the barrel is in storage. So I'm just going to send her some pictures that I already have. And then answer questions, and hopefully those pictures will be helpful to her, because she wants to build a barrel too. So
about the barrel, I don't know if you recall in Prescott when I had to give the first demonstration, and they gave me a sawhorse with some padding on the top. And they gave me a woman who had back problems to be the volunteer to demonstrate, who I wanted her, first of all, to find out what we were going to do on the barrel, which is why I introduced the barrel. But this was too painful for her, too awkward, too short. It was just wrong. It was the wrong thing. So if somebody's going to use the barrel, it needs to be of a certain height, and it needs to be padded properly and all of that. I also have the diagrams. I think I even sent them to you.
Kind of build one. I actually have them from online. It's the ones I use. I Maybe they're the same, but anyway, it's out there in the world.
You can buy it. You can still buy it from the man who made mine.
Yeah, you can buy them. You can buy them, and they're quite a lot more expensive, of course. But anyway, so we're going to wrap up here in the next few minutes. Are there any closing comments or questions that Judy that you might have? Or
no, I'm good. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you both for coming. I've got laryngitis, as you can tell, and hopefully next month that won't be the case. And
good luck with your presentation. I'd like to know what kind of response you would get.
Yeah, I'll make a report on the somewhere on the website or on our Facebook page.
Yeah, great.
I'm also going to be, I think, presenting at the Rotary Club here, but that's kind of more routine, that one. So, I've definitely got to get my voice back by the time I start doing these presentations.
Well, stop talking so much.
I wish you both well in your work. And
thank you.
Give me a call. And Judy, I know we've talked about connecting.
When you got back from your trip. So you're back, and when your voice feels better, we'll talk about moving forward. Wonderful.
Okay, thanks, ladies. And
Thank you. Feel better.
Be in touch. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Right, take care. Bye-bye.